Welcome to Least of These, where I cover the cases that need it most, because every life matters and everyone deserves justice. I'm your host, Leah D, and today I'll be bringing you the conclusion of the case of Natalie Finn in Des Moines, Iowa. Let's get right to it. Super quick refresher. After 10 calls to CPS in an 11-month span reporting that the Finn children were being starved by their foster parents, 42-year-old Nicole and 45-year-old Joseph Finn, well, technically, if you remember, it was mainly Nicole actually starving the children, but dumbass Joe or Joseph or whatever his name is knew and helped to board up windows so the kids couldn't get out of the house to get food from the neighbors and then ripped out the carpet that was soiled with urine and feces and removed the children's furniture. But anyhow, after not one or two, but 10 calls to the Iowa Department of Human Services on October 24th, 2016, 16-year-old Natalie Finn was found emaciated and barely clinging to life on her bedroom floor. Hours later, she was pronounced deceased at Blank Children's Hospital. Her two biological siblings, who we referred to as M and J, were also taken to the children's hospital, where they spent weeks recovering from malnutrition. Nicole initially had 799 stories and ultimately tried to place the blame on Natalie and the children themselves, with staff at the hospital, with investigators, and with child welfare officials. Even after Natalie's death, Nicole continued blaming the 16-year-old. The day after Natalie died, on October 25th, 2016, Nicole texted her adopted son, the one we referred to as N. You know, the one who wasn't biologically related to Natalie, the one she actually took care of. Yeah, that one. Anyhow, she texted him and stated, "I fucked up. I should have just taken her in. What the hell did I do? She hated me that much." In another text she wrote, "I can't stop thinking about CPR. I didn't do it right. I should have learned." Her son responded, "It wasn't our fault. It was hers." Nicole sent another text that day, this one to her ex-husband Joseph. It read, "Well, they fucked me." Nicole Finn had manipulated everyone around her to believe that Natalie was the problem, when nothing could have been further from the truth. But there was one person she wouldn't be able to manipulate. And that was West Des Moines Detective Chris Morgan. After a thorough investigation, on December 8, 2016, Nicole and Joseph Finn II were both arrested and charged in Natalie's murder. Nicole was charged with murder, 3 counts of first-degree kidnapping, 2 counts of child endangerment, and 1 neglect or abandonment of a dependent person. And for Joseph, well, he got 3 counts of first-degree kidnapping, 1 count of child endangerment resulting in death, 3 counts of child endangerment resulting in serious injury, and 3 counts of neglect or abandonment of a dependent person. They both initially entered pleas of not guilty. 8 days later, on December 16, 2016, after an internal review, DHS officials fired caseworker Amy Sacco and her supervisor Beth Avery for their handling of Natalie's case. DHS management also conducted coaching and counseling disciplinary actions with 2 intake workers and 2 supervisors who handled 4 child abuse reports related to the Finn family. As the criminal cases moved towards trial, Nicole Finn was up first, and her attorneys fought like hell to have the case moved out of town. Attorney Thomas Augustine said keeping the trial in Polk County was, quote, simply feeding Miss Finn to the wolves. He went on to say, "The damage is done. We have to, in the interest of justice and the Constitution, get this out of Polk County." They also tried to get evidence thrown out. That evidence? Life insurance policies on Natalie and her 2 siblings, evidence that Natalie was hit with a bat by a relative, references that M and J were so emaciated at the time of Natalie's death that they resembled concentration camp prisoners, and any testimony that Nicole Finn made distasteful comments about Natalie Finn's death when she was picking up medical records. What were those distasteful comments? I couldn't find them to know for sure, but judging from other comments made by Nicole, like calling the children worthless, I'm sure distasteful is a nice way of putting it. Despite impassioned pleas, the judge decided that they'd cross that bridge when they got there. And if during jury selection, they were unable to find an impartial jury, the case would be moved. But that wouldn't be necessary, because a jury was selected, and on Friday, December 1st, 2017, the trial began. The prosecution told the story of an abusive foster mother who hated her children and manipulated everyone around her to believe that the children were somehow flawed. This abuse had gone so far that in some ways, she had even convinced MJ and Natalie that this was the truth. She told them and anyone who would listen how awful they were, and despite every effort, there wasn't a single thing they could do right. Prosecutor Brett Lucas stated, "Even to this day, it's not clear to the children what they could have done right in the defendant's eyes." The prosecution laid it all out through witness testimony. The first responders testified that Natalie was barely clinging to life when they arrived, and that the house was filthy, and Nicole made comments about Natalie being anorexic. The ER physician at Blank Children's Hospital, Dr. Lydia Holm, testified that Natalie's body looked like, quote, "skin stretched over bones and almost white in appearance." Caseworker Amy Sacco and Deputy Kincaid also testified about their visit to the home 2 months before Natalie's death. And though it seemed they gave truthful testimony, to me, it felt as if they had a little hint of CYA syndrome while on the stand. Sacco described the condition of the house, stating, "The house was cluttered, but it wasn't the worst I've seen." She went on to say that on the day of the visit, Nicole had a roast cooking in the kitchen, and there seemed to be enough food. Both Sacco and Kincaid told the jurors about how Nicole Finn had tried to avoid them multiple times as they tried to investigate the allegations. And Supervisor Beth Avery? Oh, we'll get there. Forensic pathologist Dr. Francis Garrity took the stand and testified that Natalie was so emaciated, her body appeared like skin tinted over a skeleton. The medical examiner went on to explain that Natalie's death by starvation, was prolonged, excruciating, and cruel, and that he had sufficient information to come to a cause of death. Prosecutor Nan Horvat asked him, "Dr. Garrity, why did Natalie die?" He responded, "likely the result of cardiac arrest from the starvation." The defense tried to push back, suggesting the medical examiner couldn't have determined whether Natalie starved herself or someone had deprived her of food. But he stood firm in his belief that Natalie's death was a homicide due to denial of critical care and adequate nutrition. Not only had she been starved, she had been neglected to the point that her tiny body was covered in bed sores, and there were 3 bruises on the top of her head, which Dr. Garrity concluded were caused by blunt force trauma. How that blunt force trauma occurred, we don't exactly know for sure. Either Natalie was struck with an object, or she was weak and fell at some point. The medical examiner wasn't the only expert convinced Natalie didn't starve herself. Amy DeMoney, a behavioral therapist who treated Natalie back in 2016, testified that there was never any sign Natalie had an eating disorder. The problem she noted was that Natalie had a problem with personal hygiene, and it was something she needed to work on. But was it actually something Natalie needed to work on, or did she just need to be allowed out of her room to take care of herself? I'm not a doctor or nothing, but the way I see it, her personal hygiene could have been helped tremendously if she wasn't locked in a piss-covered bedroom. Anyhow, Detective Chris Morgan testified about the conditions of the house, the text messages in Nicole's phone calling the kids worthless, Nicole telling Joseph how much she hated them, and how Natalie had to go. Some of those messages were read aloud in the courtroom. He revealed that though Natalie and her 2 siblings shared a room, there was an extra bedroom on the main floor that housed quarantine pets, and that room came complete with a queen-size bed and sheets. You know, for the animals. The detective stated Nicole cared a lot about the animals. She did not care about the kids. Teachers and administrators told the jury how Nicole instructed them not to give Natalie food other than the meals served at school. She claimed that Natalie's reactive attachment disorder made her hoard food and that she didn't need the extra snacks. She accused her daughter of lying and being manipulative. School nurse Elena Bird Sorensen testified that she had reported child abuse in February of 2016, but that the report came back unfounded. Even after that, the nurse provided child protective workers with a list of 20 things that concerned her about Natalie and her siblings, based on her conversations with Natalie and Nicole Finn. She said on the stand, "There were times she even said she hadn't eaten for 3 or 4 days. So I would ask her, 'Natalie, why have you not eaten?' And she would make excuses. She would get that puzzled look on her face and then she would say, 'Oh, I wasn't feeling well,' or 'My mom wasn't feeling well.'" And after the nurse made that report in February of 2016, Nicole Finn asked that the nurse not seek out any more contact with Natalie, but Natalie visited her anyway. And further, when school officials found out that Natalie wouldn't be returning to school in the fall of 2016, in a staff meeting, someone from the school actually said out loud, "You know, I just had this bad feeling that that mom has those kids in cages." The principal called DHS again and made another report, but as we know, absolutely nothing was done. All that was damning enough. I mean, seriously, not only did Nicole not properly feed this child, she instructed everyone around her not to either, which takes a special kind of evil. But the prosecution wasn't finished yet, and the other children living in that home took the stand to tell the jury what it was really like living under Nicole's roof, and just how much Natalie had suffered in the days and weeks before her death, and how everyone living in that house was well aware that Natalie was slipping away. Natalie's brother Jay, who was now 16, described for the jury how he, Em, and Natalie had all slept in that bedroom on the hard linoleum floor in their own waste for months. They were trapped in their room and had to ask Nicole's permission to eat, bathe, or leave the room. And most of the time, she was either unavailable or unwilling to allow them to leave the room when they did ask. Nicole had that makeshift alarm on the door, remember, the one made with the laundry basket and pillowcase, so if the kids did leave the room, she would know all about it. Other court testimony revealed through photos taken from Nicole's laptop that she'd been propping that laundry basket tied to her children's door handle for at least 4 years. Back to Jay's testimony. Jay recalled that he had gone as long as 2 weeks without any food. The teenage boy went on to explain that he, Natalie, and Em had to sneak out their window to beg for money for food. But when Nicole found pizza boxes and other discarded food trash outside the window, she and Joseph boarded it up. Jay testified that he and his siblings wanted to run away, but they were afraid of what would happen if they did. Things had gone from bad to worse that summer of 2016, and Jay recalled that he had only left that bedroom once or maybe twice. He then went on to describe the days before Natalie died, recalling that 3 or 4 days before her death, his sister became too weak to even get up to eat. Nicole's response to this was to tell the emaciated child, "Since you're not going to get up, I'm not going to feed you." And she didn't. But M and J, concerned for Natalie, gave her water out of a syringe. At some point, he also attempted to feed Natalie yogurt. Jay testified that the day before her death, on October 23, 2016, Natalie was so weak, their adoptive mother, Nicole, told 14-year-old Em to give her a sponge bath. So she did. The following morning, Nicole sent the other brother, N, off to school and kept Jay home with Em and Natalie, which neither of the girls were enrolled in school at this time. She made Jay and Em take showers and gave them breakfast outside on the patio, which was out of character since Nicole usually forced the three siblings to eat standing in the hallway outside their bedroom. After breakfast, at some point Nicole gave the children blankets and set up a space heater in their bedroom because Natalie was very cold. She then told them all to take a nap. Jay recalled that he woke up around 8 or 9 p.m. and found Natalie. She had vomit coming from her mouth and it appeared she had no heartbeat. Jay said he freaked out near the doorway while his brother N called Joseph Finn and Nicole began to administer CPR. M, who was now 15, also took the stand. She recalled that there was a time when she was younger that Nicole treated her like, quote, "mommy's little girl," because she was the baby of the Finn children, but as she had grown older, things had changed. Nicole began to deny her food and she was locked in that bedroom alongside Jay and Natalie. In 2016, she was kept out of school, locked in the bedroom for such extended periods of time, she had to use the bathroom on the floor, and became weak because she was so hungry. M told the jury that she told her mom and her non-biological sibling, N, that she was hungry, quote, quite a lot. She went on to say, "I knew my mom knew I was hungry because I passed out." M testified that Nicole said to her, "That's what happens when you don't eat or drink for a day." At that point, prosecutor Nan Horvitt asked her, "Did you want to eat?" "Yes," she responded. The children became so desperate that M made a sign and hung it on the window. It said, "Need food and money." M stated on the stand, "I just knew one of us was going to die." They were confined to their room so much that they learned to tell the time by the location of the sun on the wall, and the date by the tornado sirens that went off at noon on the first Saturday of each month. They wanted out, but there was no escape. M recalled that she felt it was disrespectful to wake Nicole up to ask to go to the bathroom. And when they did ask to go to the bathroom or for food, Nicole would often ignore their request anyway. So eventually, they just gave up asking. After that August 17th visit from caseworker Amy Sacco, Natalie's condition declined rapidly. In the weeks before her death, Natalie couldn't stand on her own, then she needed help walking, and eventually, she couldn't even eat on her own. Her siblings tried, but with very limited resources, there wasn't much they could do. And besides, Natalie was the one who always looked out for them. M testified that while her sister was still in school, she would bring her food home, like goldfish or animal crackers, which are the same snacks the school nurse previously testified she had in her office. The day before Natalie died, her little sister gave her a sponge bath out of a kitty litter tray on the bedroom floor, because Natalie was too weak to move at that point. These two children bravely told the truth about what happened to their sister, and the jury clung to every word. They themselves had narrowly escaped death. Testimony revealed that after Natalie's death, the siblings spent more than 2 weeks in the hospital on 3,000 to 3,500 calorie diets and gained 14 and 15 pounds. The fourth sibling, N, who was 16 by this time, took the stand and told the jury about his life inside the Finn home, a life that was clearly different than that of his adopted siblings. He recalled to the jury that he had his own basement bedroom, complete with a TV and an Xbox. He had a cell phone, his own pets, and was free to come and go and eat whenever he wanted. It was clear from his testimony that he had been manipulated by Nicole Finn, probably from the moment he was adopted, as he seemed to have a lot to say about the behavior of his siblings. He testified that he had once been close with them, but as they grew older, their behavior got worse and he grew apart from them. And his mother also used to joke and have fun with the kids, but that changed too. According to N, Natalie, J, and M could at times be confrontational and physical with Nicole. He went on to say that they urinated in bottles they hid in their beds at night and sometimes refused to eat. The teenager went on to tell stories about how M had once drank out of a toilet when she was younger and claimed Natalie was the leader. N claimed that the furniture had been removed from their bedroom because it was covered in urine and feces. It came out through his testimony that he helped their mother supervise the other children on their trips to the bathroom. And when the prosecutor asked him why he had to do that, N responded, "They can't be trusted. I thought that myself, but my mom thought that too." Prosecutor Horvitt then asked N if he thought it seemed silly that he had to supervise his siblings when they went to the bathroom when Nicole wasn't available. "Kinda," he said, "but my mom wanted me to do it." Nicole constantly monitored Natalie and her siblings and blamed them for everything that went wrong in the Finn home. But as it turned out, N had gotten into trouble of his own. He testified that he was suspended from school after he was caught selling Nicole's oxycodone pills at Valley Southwoods and had to be moved to an alternative school. But Nicole obviously didn't lock him in a room, take his furniture, or starve him. This is me talking and not any of the courtroom testimony. But the abuse of one or more children inside the home, while others are seemingly taken care of, is commonly referred to as a Cinderella effect. We talked about it in Imani Moss's case. And it's more frequent than you might think. It's typically non-biological children being singled out in a household by a step-parent where biological children are present, so it's a little different in this case since everyone was adopted. But for whatever reason, N could do no wrong in Nicole's eyes, and Natalie and her siblings could do no right. It makes it all the more horrific. Nicole Finn knew how to properly care for a child. She knew how to feed them, clothe them, keep them clean and safe. For one of her adoptive children, she did things right by him, and early on it seemed she did it for them all. But at some point, she decided she resented Natalie and her two siblings, and from then on they were systematically abused, isolated, neglected, and starved. And it didn't stop with her. She enlisted anyone and everyone she could to continue their abuse, to include her other child, their adoptive sibling, which is abuse in and of itself, not to mention the fact that it's pure evil. Back to the trial before I end up on a rant. With all the evidence presented by prosecutors, it was time for the defense, which honestly, there wasn't much of one. In opening statements, defense attorney Jennifer Larson had told jurors not to judge Nicole's parenting against their own or their families or even their neighbors. Basically, she asked them not to compare Nicole's parenting with any other parenting they had ever even heard or thought about, and instead she wanted jurors to consider how Nicole's judgment might have become foggy as she struggled with health issues, little support, and the behavioral problems of four adopted children with mental health issues that worsened as they got older. Nicole's health issues were fibromyalgia and lupus. And as far as the children's mental health issues, the things they were diagnosed with are actually pretty common for children in the foster care system. Natalie's reactive attachment diagnosis was brought up every chance Nicole could get, and that didn't change in the trial. Now, wait a damn minute, because this defense attorney was asking jurors to consider the facts of this case as if Nicole was on some island of her own and facing issues so severe her judgment would have been so clouded she couldn't see that she was slowly killing three of her four children because of fibromyalgia, lupus, and reactive attachment disorder. Not to downplay any of those diagnoses, because they can be debilitating, but they don't turn you into a monster. And people raise children who have mental health conditions while they fight through their own health conditions every day and twice on Sunday. And that's not an excuse. And as far as Natalie's supposed mental health issues, was the jury not supposed to consider the fact that those issues could have been caused or exacerbated by Nicole and her abuse? I mean, everybody's gotta have a story, I guess, but this one seems stupid. Only one witness was called by the defense, forensic psychologist Dr. Carlo Giacomani, and even he didn't testify that Nicole was delusional or psychotic, only that she suffered from PTSD and major depression after a 2012 breakup with an abusive boyfriend. According to the doctor, that along with a difficult childhood and difficult relationships with her parents contributed to an emotional disconnection with others that caused her to push people away. She was dealing with that and at the same time had the added stress of multiple teens with behavioral disorders, had lost a close friend, and had her health issues. All of this together made her dissociate from reality, which made it difficult for her to realize that she needed to get help for the three starving children in her care as they withered away. That was the defense. Although there was supposed to be another defense witness, and that was supervisor at Iowa DHS, Beth Avery. Excuse me, former supervisor. Anyhow, Avery was a potential witness for the defense, but through her lawyer stated that she would not make herself available to testify. She could have been brought in on contempt of court charges, but she wasn't, since her testimony wasn't exactly needed. I mean, they already had Amy Sacco, who testified for the prosecution, and the defense got their crack at her during cross-examination. The Des Moines Register reported that Avery had spoken to defense lawyers and the whole thing had effectively been smoothed over. So that was it. After the defense put on its expert claiming Nicole could have been dissociating from reality, the prosecution brought in one rebuttal witness who disputed basically everything Dr. Carlo Giacomani had testified to. Dr. James Dennard, a former behavioral health medical director at Mercy Medical Center, testified that there was nothing in Nicole's history to suggest she had dissociative thoughts or any thoughts that separated her from reality. And further, she was not legally insane before Natalie's death. Not that they claimed she was, but that was thrown in for good measure. The doctor made it clear that there was no mental defect that caused her to fail to understand her actions. He stated, "There is nothing I found that would indicate that her condition prevented her from being able to perceive her surroundings accurately or to form intent or appreciate the consequences of her actions." And with that, the case was in the jury's hands. It took them a day to make their decision, but on December 14, 2017, Nicole Finn was found guilty on all charges, first-degree murder and 3 counts of first-degree kidnapping. A little over a month later, on January 26, 2018, Nicole Finn was handed down 3 life sentences without the possibility of parole. In a symbolic gesture, Judge Karen Romano ordered the sentences to be run consecutively. Nicole is currently serving her time in the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women. With Nicole's sentence out of the way, the children's adoptive father, Joseph Finn II, was up next. But before Joseph's case could make it through the court system, caseworker Amy Sacco was back in the news again. The Des Moines Register reported that Sacco sat down for an exclusive interview with Reader's Watchdog. It was revealed that she had appealed her firing, and she was now sitting down with the outlet claiming that she had been unable to find a job in social work for more than a year because she was made the scapegoat for a difficult child abuse case with a tragic ending. She went on to complain that others in the social work field know that she and her supervisor, Beth Avery, were fired as a result of one of Iowa's most egregious child abuse deaths. Sacco stated, "It's been hard for a lot of different reasons. I feel like I've become the face of everything wrong with DHS." Excuse me, Miss Ma'am? You are. Do I need to say it again? 10 reports in 11 months, and 3 reports after your visit. 2 of those reports you failed to do anything with besides read. How are you not the face of everything wrong with DHS? Incredibly, Sacco took it a step further, explaining that it's hard to be singled out for blame when other workers allowed Nicole and Joseph Finn to adopt 4 children from foster care. She said, "I wasn't the one who gave them a foster care license or who approved the adoptions. I didn't do the home study. But no one else has been singled out. It's just been me out here, and it takes a toll on you." It takes a toll on you? I'm sure it does. And maybe it should. Can you imagine the toll it took on Natalie when you walked out of that house and left her in it to starve to death? Sacco could place the blame on whoever did the home study years before, but she was in that home months before Natalie died, and she failed to act. I'm searching. Nope. Looks like I'm fresh out of sympathy. Back to Joseph Finn II. On March 21, 2018, he struck a deal with prosecutors and pled guilty to 3 counts of assault while participating in a felony causing a serious injury. In court, Joseph admitted that though he didn't live in the home after his 2011 divorce from Nicole, he had periodic opportunities to see the children's physical condition and often helped his ex-wife with tasks designed to keep the children under her control, like replacing the carpets and boarding up the windows. Joseph claimed that even though his children told him they were going to the bathroom on the floor of their room because they didn't get permission to leave, he didn't fully understand what was happening. But he, quote, bought into his ex-wife's version of events. He believed he was boarding up the window because the glass was cracked and the floor was a health issue. "I went over his bullshit excuses last week and I have no desire to repeat them again." He said in court he now knew that that was wrong and that he had been manipulated by Nicole. He stated, "I failed my children as a parent when they needed me the most, and I have to live with that for the rest of my life." J and M spoke in their father's defense through victim impact statements. M stated, "I think he was so confused and that Nicole Finn had tied him up in a knot. I do believe him when he says he was manipulated by Nicole because she manipulated me too. But District Court Judge Robert Hansen wasn't swayed as he addressed Joseph Finn, stating, "Mr. Finn, what happened here and what you were complicit in is at the same time heartbreaking and appalling. What you did, or maybe better put, what you failed to do, Mr. Finn, is in a microcosm what an entire nation of people did in the 30s and 40s. And they called it the Holocaust. What an entire nation of people are doing at this moment in the country Myanmar. That is, looking the other way when an atrocity is being committed. No worse than what all those millions of people did, but certainly no better." The judge then sentenced Finn to 30 years in prison. He's currently serving his sentence at Fort Dodge Correctional Facility. Both Joseph and Nicole Finn appealed their convictions, and both of their appeals were denied. Natalie Jasmine Finn's 16 short years of life have left a lasting impact on not only those that knew and loved her, but also the Department of Iowa Human Services. Major policy changes were put into effect after her death, and all I can say is, it's about damn time. And still, more needs to be done. Neighbors and classmates remember Natalie as a gentle, kind girl, a girl who always tried her best to protect her two siblings. And many believe Natalie sacrificed her own life to save theirs. May she forever be remembered. And that, my friends, is all for this week. Be sure to follow me on Instagram at @least_of_these or my Facebook at @leastofthesepodcast for details. And if you're sick of ad interruptions, I've got good news for you. You can get all your episodes ad-free, just the way you like them, for just $2 a month. And as a member of Patreon, you'll be the first to be notified when new tiers will be launched with exclusive episodes and a few bonus surprises. Head on over to patreon.com/leastofthese to support the show today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for caring. If you know something, say something. And until next time, be good to each other. Y'all are probably expecting some smart opinion to come out of my mouth right now. But this case, it's done nothing but piss me off, to be honest. And I don't even know where to start. I guess you could start with Nicole herself, who, in my eyes, is the definition of evil. She took these kids on, got paid by the state for them, and then systematically tortured and abused them, and murdered Natalie. I mean, is there another word for what she did other than torture? Because not having food for 2 weeks is like literally torture. And it only makes me hope that somewhere out there in the Iowa Department of Corrections, there's a girl at the prison who really likes her trays. Maybe she's taking them. That would be great. I mean, I'm not suggesting that should happen, because I guess that would be irresponsible of me, but if someone did take her trays, leave her without food for 2 weeks, I mean, I wouldn't be mad about it. The fact that there was a whole nother bedroom with a queen-size bed with sheets for the dogs, but these kids were, you know, crammed in a room with nothing, furniture taken. And it sounds like from the court testimony that they had just gotten blankets. There's just no defense for that. What's your defense? You obviously knew how to take care of the dogs. You obviously knew how to take care of your other children. So you did this because you wanted to. Her defense. People go through stuff every day. And I'm not here to tell you that if she really had fibromyalgia and lupus, that sucks, man. It does. But I know plenty of people with fibromyalgia and lupus, and I don't know a single one of them who's starved their children to death. Not one. There's not one that I've ever come across. that was like, you know what made me a piece of shit monster? Fibromyalgia. No. You know what made me kill somebody? My lupus. That's a slap in the face to anybody who's ever been diagnosed with either of those two things, because they get up and they go to work and they get up and they take care of their children and they don't use it as an excuse. So get all the way out of here with that. Oh, I don't like her. I also don't like the dad. I get it. I read the kid's statement because they said it and they loved their dad. That's clear. That's pretty clear. But me? No, I got nothing for him. You knew what those kids were going through. You can claim you didn't all you want, but you got the text messages. If somebody was texting me about my child like that, I promise you they'd never see him again. You'd never see me again either. Call my kid worthless and see what happens. Okay? Let's get it straight. He got what he deserved too. I saw people in the comments like, well, he wasn't there. What was he supposed to do? Take care of his damn kids? That's what he was supposed to do, ma'am. He was supposed to take care of his kids, but he didn't. And then I can't leave it alone with old Amy Sacco and Beth Avery. Cry me a damn river, Amy Sacco. You want to take it all the way back to when the house got approved for to be a foster home? That was like years. Like, I couldn't find the exact date, but those kids had been in the Finn custody since they were like, what, 2 and 3? You want to point the blame there? You were there 2 months before you walked through the house. And remember, you were the one who emailed her and let her know you had that little court document granting access, gave her all the time to clean up the house. So I'm sure it wasn't in the worst condition it could possibly be. And I'm sure she cleaned it up some. She had to see the writing on the wall. But it was bad enough that you knew. Looking at those kids, you knew. You knew. You know how I know you knew? Because you wanted to verify with the doctor that they were skinny children and they weren't being starved. Everybody was telling you they were being starved. The kids were telling you that themselves. Did you expect them to tell you that with her standing there? Did you expect them to tell you that after all those reports that had been ignored? Can't find work as a caseworker? Yay. I don't know that you should ever work in casework again. I mean, everybody deserves redemption. Well, most people. But maybe you're better suited for a different job, one that doesn't have life or death consequences. How about that? And then Beth Avery refusing to testify. Lovely. That's lovely, ma'am. You know, you couldn't even own up to the role you played in this, and you played a role. You were the supervisor. I say it all the time. People in positions of authority have to be held to a higher standard. And frankly, I'm disgusted that you would go on TV or on the news or on the newspaper, whatever the hell it was a newspaper. I'm disgusted that you would go in the newspaper and talk about the toll it's taken on you. Disgusted. I'm disgusted. Those children had to live through that abuse and Natalie's dead. But oh, it's taken a toll on you because you can't be in social work anymore and you were held accountable for your actions. Gross. It's also a disgrace to all the social workers out there who bust their ass every day because those people do exist. I know. I've had to work with some. And let me tell you, there is no way in hell the ones I know would have read those reports and been like, yeah, it's fine. They're just skinny. Ain't no damn way. And, you know, I can talk this shit because your own department and an internal review said it too. You should have took action. And now a 16-year-old girl is dead because you just what? Read the reports. And I don't want to place more blame on the social workers and the caseworkers than I do Nicole and Joseph Finn, because ultimately they're responsible for what happened. They are. But also, your job is to protect children and you failed. And you failed repeatedly. Can you imagine the school officials? Like, they did everything, man. I said last week that there were no good players in this case, really, you know, besides the kids and the detective. But those school officials were too, man. They tried everything, and that nurse, God love her. She was still slipping Natalie snacks, even after they told her not to. We love the school nurse. We also love the principal. And we love everyone at the school who literally screamed from the rooftops, like, man, y'all got to do something about this. This is bad. They did what they could do. They reported, and they didn't stop reporting, but it went nowhere. And that's absolutely tragic. And I think that's why I have nothing smart to say about this case besides the system is broken and it needs to change. And I don't have all the answers. I surely don't. But somebody out there does. I think it starts with people taking the time to read the reports, to investigate them, because we went through that investigation last week. It wasn't good. I've seen better investigations into a car break-in where like $20 was taken. It's terrible. It's terrible. And I could go on forever, but I won't, because it'll just make me madder. I'll talk at you guys next week. Love you more than my luggage. Bye, boo thing.